Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, with the constant stream of high-profile political news out of Washington, it's easy to miss significant changes at lower levels of our federal government. One such change, occurring now, concerns the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. Its head, Scott Pruitt, is making fundamental changes to the way it gets scientific advice and who it gets that advice from. Joining me now, two scientists who, until very recently, were involved in advising the EPA. One, in fact, still is, we think. Deborah Swackhammer is with us. She is Professor Emerita of Environmental Health Sciences and Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. And Peter Thorne, Professor and Head of the Department of Occupational and Environmental Health at the University of Iowa. Deb and Peter, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Thanks, Ben. Nice to be here.
I kind of hesitated in relaying your relation to the EPA because it has changed within the last few days and perhaps is changing even today. Deb, you are currently, correct me if I'm wrong, chair of the Board of Scientific Counselors.
Yes, I have had that position for 2 years, and I have found out from the media that Mr. Pruitt has named a new chair. And when I inquired with EPA about this, they informed me that I would be getting a letter explaining that I was no longer going to be serving as chair, but I would serve on the committee until my term ends in 4 months.
But you found this out from the media. You were not informed first by the EPA?
No.
Okay. How long have you served on the Board of Scientific Counselors with the EPA?
I have been the chair for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You are also a former chair of the EPA Science Advisory Board. That's another board that goes by the acronym SAB. And Peter Thorne, you were, until a few days ago, chair of that board. You've served 6 years, the last 2 years, as its chair. You are no longer its chair.
Correct. I was term limited, but I was nominated to continue. And I found out from the media that someone else had been asked to chair that going forward.
Mm-hmm.
I have not gotten official word, but my name disappeared from the website this week, so that's confirmation.
I mean, just comment. This is unusual, right? To be informed of leaving, even though it was term limited, to find it out from the media, Peter and Deb?
It's totally unusual. Usually the agency will call you and have conversations with you and, you know, give you a heads up. And this particular EPA has been extremely opaque, very non-transparent, and they have not been communicating hardly anything. I have to call them and basically, you know, ask to find out what's going on. And then, you know, that's how I found out that I really wasn't going to be chair, but I'm still on the committee.
Mm-hmm.
And I had nothing in writing to show me that was the case.
Before we talk about the changes and what the sort of Scott Pruitt's new vision for the advisory, the scientific advisory role at the EPA, let's talk about the way your boards have worked in the past. Perhaps, Deb, you can take, since you are sort of in another world, but let's say you're chair of the Board of Scientific Counselors. To walk us through with the idea of what's behind that board and how that works in the greater picture of the EPA.
Sure. So there are many boards that advise EPA on very specific things, and most of them were created by Congress to provide oversight, scientific oversight at EPA. The Board of Scientific Counselors, or BOSC, was created by EPA to help them, help advise them on the science that they do internally in the agency. So we're down in the weeds. We are down at the 5,000-foot level advising them on what research to do and whether the research is being done to the best to the best standards. And it's really just talking to EPA. And it's peer review of the science that they're doing in the agency, the basic science. So we're very different from the Science Advisory Board, which Peter can talk about, which is the largest board, the most powerful board, if you will, and it has a much larger role to play in terms of advising the administrator.
Okay, Peter, explain the SAB, the Science Advisory Board of the EPA.
So I think it's important for listeners to understand that the EPA primarily is a science-based organization. Its mission is to protect human health and the environment, and so to do that, they need to have the best science advice they can have. So Congress in 1978 passed a law that created the Science Advisory Board. So it's chartered by Congress, and it ensures that the EPA is using and applying the best underlying science to all the decisions that they make. The science that the agency uses is exceedingly complex. It covers toxicology, exposure science, environmental engineering, systems biology, economics, social science. So this board is comprised of 48 scientists and scholars, who most of whom have extensive publication records and research in these areas. And our function really is to make sure that the agency gets the science right. Because if we don't, we risk failing to prevent injury and illness to the public, and so, or perhaps minimize regulating minimal risks, which is an equally problematic issue.
Mm-hmm. And an important point, especially in these times, is it's not a political organization in any way, Deb. I mean, this has, since the 1970s, the EPA was created during the Nixon administration, but Peter is referring to some changes in the 1970s, it sounds like. So this has gone through both Democratic and Republican administrations in its present form up to now.
Yes, and for the past several administrations, these scientific boards have not been interfered with by the administration. We don't get told, oh, we don't like your opinion, go back and change it. They haven't messed around with the appointments to the board. It has not been political. We don't really get involved in the regulatory side of EPA. BOSC absolutely never discusses regulations. The Science Advisory Board reviews the science that often does go into regulation, but they don't discuss the regulations or make policy decisions. And so, really, we are meant to be objective, independent of who's president and administrator, and objective on the issues that are in front of us.
Okay, so let's talk now about the fundamental changes that are underway with these boards, the way the EPA gets science for a lot of big policy nationwide. Scientists now who get grants from the EPA are not to sit on any of these boards. Is that the central issue that Scott Pruitt is pushing right now, Peter?
I think there's been two fundamental shifts. One is that increasingly science and scientists are being marginalized in terms of their participation on the board. So a number of scientists who had served a first term, 3 years, very admirably, and would have normally come back for a second three-year term to serve, were replaced by people who are not primarily scientists but represent industry, the regulated industry. The second thing that happened is that there was an edict that if one had received funding for research from the EPA, that person would not be eligible to serve unless they gave up those federally funded grants.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that a fair point, though? If you have a vested interest, a financial stake, Deb, in the advice that you're looking after, if you're getting grants from the same agency you advise, isn't it going to be the tendency there for it to be tailored so that it favors maintaining a grant or winning a grant?
On the face of it, it does look that way, doesn't it? But in fact, EPA has very, very strict black and white ethics laws and rules. And so if you have a grant and you're an air specialist and you're studying particulate matter in the air, that hardly would mean you'd have a conflict in terms of advising the agency on water-related matters or health-related matters. And so if you were to then be in front of be part of a discussion around an issue that did deal with particulate matter, you would recuse yourself, or the ethics people would have you recuse yourself. So there's already a very involved procedure in place that prevents conflict of interest around a subject matter where you may have a financial conflict. And so this particular, this was just a guise. This was a totally unnecessary executive order coming out of the administrator to prevent these people from serving. Just it's throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Anybody who had EPA funding for any purpose could no longer serve. And that eliminated an enormous percentage of some of the most valuable scientists that could advise him. And it's because he doesn't want that advice. He wants advice that is going to correspond to and support his agenda, and he does not want independent advice.
Okay, if you just joined us, talking with Deb Swackhammer. She is Professor Emerita of Environmental Health Sciences and Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. Peter Thorne is with us, the University of Iowa professor and head of the Department of Occupational Environmental Health. Both have been involved with EPA advising boards, the Board of Scientific Counselors, also the EPA Science Advisory Board, and talking about the big changes underway at the EPA under its head, Scott Pruitt. So talk about, Peter, who you understand is replacing you until a few days ago were chair of the EPA Science Advisory Board. Describe why this is a fundamental change. What is coming after? What is in place now that is new?
Right. So Deb was just referring to the scientists who were replaced under this statement from Mr. Pruitt that he wanted advisors who were providing independent arm's length input. Well, what the scientists are being whom the scientists are being replaced by are industry scientists, people who have worked for industry, people who have worked for law firms that have sued the EPA.
These are people with science degrees, doctors and doctorates and so forth. They have been educated. It's not like they're not educated, but you're just saying they went and chose to work for industry rather than academia.
Correct. And in many cases, they have not had the type of careers where they're doing research, evaluating science, doing peer review, publishing research articles. In many cases, they have taken a different career path. And so to say that these scholars who have had some research support from the agency are biased, but then to say some of these industry people who've worked for lawyers suing the EPA are arm's length independent advice is, I would say, disingenuous.
Mm-hmm. Disingenuous. Deb, what do you think? I mean, it sounds like it's a new approach, but, I mean, and you have, as those with careers in academia, you have an interest in saying, let's do it the way we did before, but it's a new approach, but isn't necessarily a bad approach to take a different view of environmental challenges in this country. Can you argue the point?
Well, I certainly have fundamental differences in how the EPA should be fulfilling its mission, but that's my opinion as a citizen. And in terms of providing science advice to the agency, if they, as Peter said, it's a science-driven agency, and if they don't get the science right, they will have poor policy and they won't protect public health. And what is happening here is it appears that what Mr. Pruitt is doing is taking his scientific advisors. He's not getting rid of science advice. He is shaping science advice to basically become a rubber stamp or supporter of his agenda. And there, my argument there is that I forget what EPA is going to do with its agenda. It's that scientific integrity, just the basic idea of the integrity of science, has now been threatened, and it is going to be eroded at EPA because the Science Advisory Board is considered one of the top advisory boards with the top scientists in the country that serve on it. And now it's got a whole bunch of people with vested interests that are not the top scientists in the country. So he's not going to get good science advice. He's going to get good political advice, I guess.
Right.
But he's not going to get science advice.
Let's get a little more concrete. We've been viewing this from 30,000 feet. I want some key examples. We hear science advice and so forth. Can each of you, from your area of expertise, perhaps give me an example of key inputs the board has given in the past that really turned out to be significant and how this may not happen in the future in the same way? Peter.
So The Science Advisory Board last year evaluated a 1,000-page report that had been prepared by the agency on the potential impacts of hydraulic fracturing for oil and gas on drinking water resources. So this report, draft report, came to the Science Advisory Board for a review, and we spent an enormous amount of energy studying this document and evaluating it. And in the end, the Science Advisory Board could not agree with a couple of the major statements within this report and concluded, contrary to what the draft report said, that there were instances of significant impacts on local drinking water resources from hydraulic fracturing. And really, the Science Advisory Board, based on their evaluation of the science, reversed one of the major statements in the draft report. And this was very influential, and it was not necessarily what the oil and gas industry wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm. Deb, do you have a concrete example that we can relate to?
The Science Advisory Board also reviewed some of the scientific evidence that went into the rulemaking of the Waters of the United States, which is essentially a rule to decide what waters, what water bodies, you know, what lakes and rivers, wetlands, et cetera, are under federal jurisdiction or under state jurisdiction.
Right, and just a very contentious issue, both in Iowa and where you're from, Deb, Minnesota. So,
yes.
You know, farmers are very concerned with, you know, does this drainage ditch or is that under this federal jurisdiction or is it just my drainage ditch, right?
Right, and it is very contentious, and EPA came up with its rule, and it was a very complicated scientific discussion. But because of its complexity and because of its controversial nature, parts of that rulemaking, the science that went into parts of that rulemaking, went to the Science Advisory Board, and they did a review of the science around the connectivity of basically wetlands and isolated water, how connected does water have to be before it becomes connected to water that is federal water. And the Science Advisory Board's review of that really, really supported the science and urged EPA to be even more clear and more, use all the evidence they could to support what they said was a strong case for that. And so there you have the Science Advisory Board not disagreeing with the EPA, but basically saying you have a stronger case to make for this, make your case even stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with a different Science Advisory Board, one that has vested interests, you may get a very different review of the same thing, and it won't be based on top scholarly activity and what we know about the ecology of these systems. It'll be based on vested interests. And so that's my concern, is that you're going to get a very different kind of, you're not going to get objective science review from these new boards.
Mm-hmm. We're running out of time. I'd like to have you tell us, Deb, a little bit about the story of testimony you gave to Congress back in May. Something unusual happened. Tell us the story quickly of what happened and why it was unusual.
Sure. So back in May is when we found out that about 80% of the Board of Scientific Counselors was not going to get renewed for a second term, and they'd already been verbally told they would be. So this was a huge shock, and it meant that the board came to a complete stop, and they canceled all future meetings. And so I was very concerned as chair. I had not been my term was still current, so I stayed on the board, but I was very concerned about what this was saying about what EPA was doing with its advisors. And so the House Committee on Science, Subcommittee on the Environment, asked me to come to Congress and testify on the concept of scientific integrity. And so I did this. I prepared my testimony and went to Washington. And the night before I gave my testimony, Scott Pruitt's chief of staff, Ryan Jackson, had sent me a series of emails. And as I corresponded with him by email, one, it became clear he wanted to review my testimony, and I'm not his witness, and so this was inappropriate. I told him it's inappropriate, and I should not share my testimony with him. It was my testimony, and I'd already submitted it. And he went back and forth and really, really wanted my testimony and was very angry I was testifying. And finally he indicated he got a copy of my testimony, which was embargoed and supposedly not available. And then he told me to change a sentence in it. which was a very powerful sentence having to do with the behavior of Mr. Pruitt. And I refused, and of course, I told the House staff about this, and they have subsequently sent letters of protest to Mr. Pruitt and to the Investigator General of the EPA, complaining about Mr. Jackson's behavior, which is, the House staff claims, is actually illegal.
Mm-hmm. You did, in fact, end up testifying.
I did testify, yes, mm-hmm. as a private citizen, which I have the right to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just to wind things up, let me get, in a few words from each of you, what you think this means going forward. The new approach by the head of the APA, Scott Pruitt, what do you see happening? I mean, how will it possibly impact the citizens of this state, of Minnesota, of Iowa, of the nation? Peter Thorne.
If we don't get the science right, we risk failing to prevent childhood cancers and other illnesses among the populace from industrial pollutants. On the other hand, if we go the other way, we risk wasting money and regulating minimal risks, which doesn't benefit the public good. So the Science Advisory Board has been that independent external check on the validity of the EPA science.
Mm-hmm. What do you have to add to that in closing, Deb?
Yeah, and Peter has it right just perfectly. I'd like to say my bigger concern is the general erosion of the value of science to the public. I think we have taken science for granted for a long time because we have clean water and clean air. And I worry that the general public needs to be reminded how important science is. And so one of the reasons that I'm speaking out on this is to raise awareness of the fact that good science is incredibly necessary to have good regulation and good protection of our environment, and that we need to pay attention because these things are happening at EPA with very little pushback. And so we need to make everyone aware again of the importance of science in our regulatory decision-making.
Deb Swackhammer of the University of Minnesota, Peter Thorne of the University of Iowa, thank you very much for your views on this change at the EPA.
Thanks for bringing this issue up, Ben. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
A short postscript to that conversation, which was recorded yesterday. We reached out to the EPA for their explanation of the change, and here's what an EPA spokesperson said in an email response. Administrator Pruitt issued a directive yesterday to ensure independence, geographic diversity, and integrity in EPA science committees. Membership on these three boards consists of qualified scientists who will help strengthen public confidence in EPA science. Those with current grants can decide if they would like to continue serving and separating themselves from the grants as their terms expire. Well, coming up, I talk with the president of Simpson College, Jay Simmons. This week, the private college, based in Indianola, announced a new program to offer free tuition for students who show financial need. That's after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, perhaps you heard in our news on Monday, Simpson College announced a move that's believed to be a first of its kind in the state. The Indianola-based college says it will offer free tuition for students who meet certain criteria. Simpson College President Jay Simmons joins me now to talk about the new plan. It's being called the Simpson Promise. President Simmons, welcome to our program.
Thanks so much, and Ben, please feel free to call me Jay.
Okay, I will. Let's talk about the Simpson Promise, a new tuition plan offering free tuition to who qualifies?
The program works in this way. Students who qualify must come from a household with an adjusted gross income on their 2016 tax return of $60,000 or less. So be an Iowa resident, have that income level, and apply to the federal government for federal student aid through the free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA form, and agree to live on campus if they otherwise meet all of our admission criteria. We will use the Pell Grant program and the Iowa Tuition Grant program to cover the full cost of tuition for those students for their first year. So in other words, they will have no out-of-pocket expense for their first year of attendance for tuition at Simpson College. They'll be responsible for room and board charges. And if they take a biology class and there's a lab fee or something, that sort of thing. But the tuition charges will be covered that first year.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me in round numbers what this means for a student in this category in terms of savings that they won't have to pay?
Yeah, typically a student in this income category in the past would have paid around $7,000, $8,000 in tuition for that first year of attendance at Simpson College. That will go away. And so their room and board charges are we're very competitive in that regard. So living on campus for that student would cost for that first year roughly not quite $8,000, a little bit shy of $8,000 to live on campus.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more about how this will be funded. Pell Grants, other inputs, including Simpson College itself?
Yeah, the way this program works is that these families are typically eligible for support for a Pell Grant, which is the federal funding program for federal financial aid for students in this income range. These families are also typically eligible for support from the Iowa Tuition Grant. Now, the levels of those two grant programs will vary from one family to the next, but generally they qualify for those two programs. We'll accept that grant program from Pell and from the Iowa Tuition Grant in lieu of any tuition charge over and above. So that will cover their full cost for tuition that first year.
Mm-hmm. How will Simpson College fund what is essentially not taken care of?
Well, in terms of what those students would have paid in the past, as I said, that would be maybe $7,000, $8,000 they would have paid for tuition charges that we will not be collecting. Our hope is that those families will look upon Simpson as an attractive option to enroll. So for us, the finances work if we enroll maybe 18 students in that income range that we didn't enroll this year. So in terms of how that is covered on our operating budget, we don't have to worry too much about that side of it so long as a few more of those families come to Simpson. Historically, this is a population that we have served in very high numbers. It's not uncommon at all to look back over our history and see somewhere between 25, 30, sometimes 35% of our students being members of families who would qualify for what is now the Simpson Promise program. But what we've noticed in the last couple of years is that more and more families in that income range are not seeing a private higher education as an attractive alternative for them.
Mm-hmm.
This helps us make sure that we're continuing to serve a part of our basically historic population and a part of our mission historically that we've seen slip away from us in the last couple of years. So we want to have to give them an opportunity and say to them, private higher education is still a great option for you to consider, and here's why we're making it affordable so that you can be at Simpson and have that as one of your alternatives to consider.
Mm-hmm. Beyond the benefit this gives, obviously, to qualifying students in that income bracket, are you interested in this move in giving students from lower-income families this opportunity in order to also improve the education at Simpson College itself?
One of the things that is important to us is to have a diverse and inclusive student body. And that diversity and inclusion means obviously income diversity as much as it means racial, ethnic, and other types of diversity and inclusion. So we don't want to be a place where families who come from this kind of an income level look upon private higher education as being somehow out of reach. It's very important for us when we think about what a baccalaureate degree can mean for a family, particularly for a student who is a first-generation college student. This is, if you will, their path to social mobility. This is a way we can help those families achieve the kinds of aspirations they might have for their student.
Mm-hmm. How unique is this among private colleges?
I don't know that I can speak to the numbers nationally. You would see in some very wealthy types of institutions a need-blind and no-loan promise And I can think of some colleges in the East with endowments much, much larger than ours who have had programs like this for a few years. Simpson has a very healthy endowment. We're in the top third or so nationally with our overall endowed resources. But we are not in that level of endowment that you would see where these institutions have $750 to $1 billion endowments. We'd love to be in that category, but we're not. So for us, it's a somewhat different situation for us. How many are there around the country like us making this kind of an offer? I don't know that I have hard numbers in that way, but I don't think it's very widespread.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is something that public universities in the state can't or don't do. In fact, tuition, of course, in the news, going up at our public universities by good numbers in the coming years. This is sort of ironic, isn't it, that this is something you would more likely expect from a public institution, a public university, in terms of the mission to serve all regardless of income level?
Well, I can only say that for us as a private institution, and this would be true for Iowa's private institutions generally, we have historically tended to serve a higher proportion of families, first-generation families and families, say, in this income range than some other types of institution. So for us, it's a part of an historical commitment and a promise that we think we need to keep for the future to a group of families and prospective students that we have served for a very long time. So in terms of the public and private distinction, we have a great public system of higher education in our state, and we always need to keep that in front of us. But this is something that we can do as a private institution that is important to us and complements the mission that we've historically pursued.
Mm-hmm. This announcement was made on Monday. What kind of reaction have you heard since? I know it's played out in the media quite a bit, this move. What's been the reaction that has meant the most to you?
I had an email from one of our alums who is a retired member of the clergy. They came across my desk just today, and I could not have had a kinder, more supportive note than the message I received from this alumnus, this of ours, who talked about how this is so important to the mission and identity of the institution and what it can mean for families in our state who are looking for this kind of an educational alternative. Before we finished the news conference yesterday, I'm told that we had four applications from students who are eligible to participate in the program. So I suppose that speaks to the power of social media. That's the second reaction I would point to that has meant a great deal to me. It tells me that we're meeting a need for some families and that word is getting out to them about what this could mean for them.
Mm-hmm. Do you hope this will spur other colleges in the state, private colleges, to follow suit? Is this a challenge of sorts?
Well, you know, all of us as private institutions worry deeply about making sure that we are affordable and accessible to the students we serve. And a variety of us, well, all of us in private higher education are taking different approaches to try to meet that challenge. This works for us. When I think about the great work that our peers are doing around the state, they've tried some other alternatives and will try different alternatives. As they look to meet their own enrollment needs and try to serve the populations that are important to them. So I think we'll have a variety of responses, and that, frankly, is what has made our system of private higher education in this state so robust for so long and such a vital part of the higher education universe in the state of Iowa for generations now.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Jay Simmons is my guest this half hour, president of Simpson College in Indianola, talking initially, we have time for a few other things, but that this week, the Indianola-based college says it will offer free tuition for students who meet certain financial criteria. You mentioned that this is in keeping with the mission of Indianola. The mission of Simpson College. But also, I understand you grew up in a blue-collar family. So, is there a connection to you personally in your upbringing that makes you feel this is the right move?
Well, I would have to admit that is true. That I take this whole notion of what we're trying to accomplish very personally. I was first generation college in my family. My father was an assembly line worker for Ford Motor Company and poured aluminum transmission cases for most of his life. And my parents were both very committed to me going to college, and to say it made a difference in the path I took would be an understatement. And so I'm deeply grateful to them for their commitment, and do personally feel a commitment to making the same kind of opportunity available to the students we have served. I had a chance to go to an institution very much like Simpson College, a small Methodist-affiliated arts and sciences college, and would not be living the life I have lived if not for that opportunity. So my hope is that by doing this, others will have the same kind of experience over the course of their lives.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about higher education, its affordability in 2017?
You know, there have been so much in the press about the cost of going to college and tuition increases and so forth, and all of us are deeply concerned about those issues. But there's also been a lot of misinformation out there, too, about how families are paying for higher education, levels of debt, and so on. Someone did a study about 2 years ago, and I wish I could cite more clearly where this study came from, but basically some researchers looked at some of the main news sources in the country, the New York Times, the LA Times, Chicago Tribune, the major news networks, and so on, and looked at all of their lead stories about college tuition costs over the preceding 2 or 3 years. If those were your sole database for determining the level of student debt in the United States, you would have come up with an average of about $92,000 in student debt for American college students graduating from America's colleges and universities. Well, the actual number is about $30,000 in debt for students across the United States. Something like one-third of all college students in the United States last year graduated debt-free. When you look at the median number, it's $10,000, so 50% of college students who graduated last year had an overall debt level of $10,000 or less. And when you think about that average number of $30,000, the point that I try to remind folks is, how much did you spend on your last car? And that's a depreciating value on that car, whereas a college degree gains in value over the course of your life when we consider the investment you're making in yourself and what that means for your overall lifetime earnings. You come out light years ahead financially by having a college degree as compared to not having a college degree. It's not to say we're not concerned about debt and the cost. We absolutely are, and all of us are working as a sector to find ways to hold those in check. But we also need to remember the investment that people are making in themselves and what that can mean for their own prospects over their careers.
Jay Simmons, president of Simpson College, with us, if you've just joined us. I'd like to talk about a few other things quickly before our time gets away from us. Let's talk a little bit about the program known as DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, a program established by the Obama administration, allowing undocumented people who entered the country as minors before they turned 16, to have a renewable two-year period of deferred action from deportation. Now, these people are also known as Dreamers. Back in September, you said in an email that no matter what happens to the DACA program, which our current president, Trump, has begun phasing out, your college does not nor does intend to maintain any list tracking students' documentation status. Can you give us an update on that? For instance, do you know how many DACA students you have enrolled now?
I don't. We do not keep an overall count of how many students are in the college without documentation status. We have some, but I couldn't tell you how many there are, and that's pretty common for most institutions of higher education, particularly among private higher educational institutions. We don't track that number.
How do you know you have some? When you say you have some, you must have an idea if you have a dozen, two dozen, or in the hundreds.
Well, I know that we have some students who have identified themselves as Dreamers, and they are very much a vital part of this campus and its activities. So I know that we have those students here, but I couldn't hazard a guess with any firm basis about how many students we might actually have in that category.
Mm-hmm. What do you believe is your obligation to these DACA students, however many there are, as Simpson College's president, given this new immigration environment under President Trump?
When I think about the students I do know who are at Simpson College as dreamers, these are young folks that any institution of higher education in the country would be proud to have as a part of their student body. Some of them are leaders on campus. Some of them have been in the United States since they were literally infants. They don't know any other place. This is home to them. So for a place like ours, and I think you would find this to be true for most of us in higher education, we want to do everything we can to help those students achieve their degrees and feel as much a part of our campus community as any other student would at on our campus. They deserve that, and they have great prospects ahead of them if we can help them achieve their degrees and see them go on to successful careers. They're a part of this community. They're a part of the people we should be serving. And you know, just to put it in strictly financial terms, because they will leave with a high-quality educational experience, they will be extremely productive members of our larger society later. They will pay taxes that will support other programs and all of us and benefit the welfares of our communities through not only their taxes, but through their participation in civic organizations, their work, and so many other ways. So I hope that we can remember that as a part of our national dialogue when we think about what these students represent to our overall health financially and civically in the years ahead.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard of any of your DACA students at Simpson College running into problems? Are they, for instance, worried about potential deportation? Do they come to your faculty, your staff with such worries? Are you working with ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency?
Well, all of our students that of whom I'm aware do have a lot of anxiety, as one would expect, about what the coming months will bring. The program, as we all know, expires in the next several months, and none of us are certain about what will happen after that time. My hope is that we will see some congressional action of some sort that will take care of these students and give them some sense of direction about what their future will be. Because, and as I said earlier, many of them have no other home than this one.
Mm-hmm. Suppose you got some information that one of your DACA students was potentially going to be deported. What action would you take?
Well, we have made available to our students information about a variety of resources on which they can draw for legal assistance. And certainly we would want to make appeals on their behalf. The students that I know of who are at Simpson College are ones that we want to support in every legal way that we can. And we certainly would try to do whatever we can to help those students complete their degrees here. Again, we have to respect the law. It is what it is. But we want to be an advocate for those students insofar as it is possible for us to do so to help keep them here and continue to be productive members of these communities.
Mm-hmm. In what ways are you liaisoning with ICE, the immigration authorities in this country? Do you have any contact with them?
Well, most of our contact has been with our congressional delegation in Washington. And I think if you talk with any of us who are in Iowa's private colleges, you would hear from all of us that we have, in some fashion or other, made contact with our members of the House of Representatives and certainly with our senators' offices, asking them to support the DREAM Act and other legislation that has been put before the Congress to give these students status and take this worry away from them so that they can continue with their courses of study and go on to be the productive members of the American society that we know they will be.
Mm-hmm. And what has been the response? Five of six of our congressional members are Republicans. This is a Republican issue. What has the response been to those appeals?
Well, I have received acknowledgments in each case from our members that I have contacted. They tell me that they are looking at the legislation, that they are working with their fellow legislators to come up with some viable solution, and my hope is that we can work with them to find whatever that legislation might be that can be enacted before the Congress and get us to the other side of an effective and reasonable solution for these students.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, briefly, if I may, you've had your main campus, as I mentioned, in Indianola, but there's a satellite campus in Ankeny. I understand that's to close earlier next year. Can you tell us briefly why?
Yeah, certainly can. We started that program in Ankeny many years ago. What we found, however, is that most of these students were far more interested in online options. So we're taking the resources that we were devoting to the site in Prairie Trail and diverting those into a greater online presence. So next fall, we'll have new programs online in business administration. Our master's in criminal justice program will move fully online. And so forth, and make those options available because the students up there are telling us that that will serve them better.
Okay, we've run out of time. Thank you so much, Jay Simmons, president of Simpson College in Indianola. We appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.